Okay, I think we'll get started and call the meeting to order. We do not have a quorum yet, so we can't officially take votes on the bill, but we will start to get things into order. Members, we have three bills on the agenda today. We have House File 179, which is Dabney. His Head Start program is modified. He wants the start to come down. We have House File 276, which is my bill, which is the dependent care credit is modified. And we have House File 203, which is the Minnesota Child Savings Account Task Force Initiative. So the first thing is Ms. Adrians is going to do a short fiscal overview. Are you ready to go with that? Okay.
Okay, I'll be very brief. Thanks to you, Madam Chair. Now, you should all have it's two spreadsheets in your packets, and one side is called it's the education finance levies, and the other one, it should be non-state aid. So if you have both of those. And first what I'll do is I just want to kind of go over a few things for each of them. Let's start with the levies page. And I'm just getting familiar with how levies work, so I'll try to answer questions, but it's a little new for me still. What this shows is just there are a few programs under the committee's jurisdiction that their total program revenue is state aid plus levy funding. And so you can see from lines 4 through 11 on the spreadsheet, it's programs like basic community ed, early childhood family education, there's an EGFE home visiting piece. Extended day is just a school age care program, adults with disabilities, and then other community ed programs. And so I think the only other thing I want to mention with this is that the way that the levy amount is determined usually is that you take the tax rate that is appropriate for whichever program it is, and you multiply that by the adjusted net tax capacity for the area, which that's just the total property value in that area. And again, if anyone's really interested, I can try to get into more detail for you at another time. And so, and the other thing I want to mention, with the governor's recommendations with making some adjustments to the property tax, that doesn't impact any of the levies under the community service fund. So the difference between the governor's recommendations and the current law is zero for all of these programs. So. Okay, and if you'll quickly look at the other spreadsheet, that's the non-state aid. So things I want to point out, what I did was I attempted at the request of Representative Downey to gather some information about some of the federal funds, like grants that go to some of these programs, and then whether they have other things like tuition and fees that help pay for them. And so it's hard to find some of this information, but like for programs like Head Start, the federal share is pretty substantial. And I wrote on there that it's estimated. I didn't get exact forecasted numbers for the future years, but it typically in the past has been around like $84-85 million range, so I felt like it was okay to just say that for right now. For child care, if you look down on lines 20 through 23, you'll see that MFIP has a federal share, and then basic sliding fee has a federal share and a county share. And the agency, when they testified, they went over a little bit of this. But and the amounts that they get for the federal share, they'll fluctuate from year to year, and that's based on how much state aid there is. But typically, the total aid, you know, the federal plus the state aid, is fairly constant from year to year. Let's see. And then on the right-hand side, I just included some notes if there was information that I had about where program revenue came from, if it was in terms of fees. So it just gives you just kind of an idea of if the program is getting any additional money coming in. So areas like one that I thought was interested was the school-age care on line 10. That one has some levy money, but they also get 90% of their program revenue comes from fees, or it did in 2007. So I think that's it. If you have any questions, please feel free to ask.
Representative Downey?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Adrians, for putting this together. I'm sure this wasn't easy. Quick question. So the kind of the departures from the 08-09 fiscal year are down in the federal area. Are those just kind of the natural variations in the program, or is that somehow reflective of the kind of the state reductions in the Health and Human Services area?
Ms. Adrian?
Oh, well, Madam Chair, Representative Downey, you're referring to the child care pieces? Yeah. A lot of it has to do with the demand for the program as well, but in some years, you know, you'll see that there will be a smaller portion of state aid, and the federal aid sometimes will fill in that gap, so there'll be more of that. And then if the, you know, it kind of goes both ways. But there's, you know, even the total aid, I expected to see it increase every year, but it doesn't. Some years you'll have more total aid appropriated for the program, and then it goes down the following year. So I think a lot of it has to do with demand. But with some of these, you know, with the federal stimulus package, the numbers will certainly change depending on what comes out of that.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you. It's very helpful to get the update. Next, we have a new staff member with us, Mike Stoll, right? And we want to welcome you to the committee, and you know the special induction ceremony for this committee. You need to tell us your favorite childhood game and where you lived when you were 3 years old, as well as introducing yourself.
Okay. Well, thank you. I actually lived in Columbus, Ohio. I recently moved from Ohio here to the Twin Cities, and my wife's from Minneapolis. So I was pretty easily entertained when I was young, so I would probably say Connect Four was one of my favorite games. So,
well, thank you. It's always interesting to see what the favorite games are, so I appreciate that. Members, we do have a quorum, so that means passing the minutes. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes?
And Chair, so moved.
Representative Ward moves approval of the minutes for February 5th. Is there any discussion? Okay. Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. The motion prevails and the minutes for February 5th are approved. Next, we will proceed with the bill. I see that Representative Davin is ready.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd like to, let's see. I have to have someone to move the bill. Is there a committee member that would like to move the bill? Representative Kulik Jackson?
Yes, I move Bill 179.
Okay. Representative Kulik Jackson has moved House File 179 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Omnibus Bill. Representative Dabney, if you'd like to explain your bill.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Currently in Minnesota, a number of Head Start programs are able to provide early Head Start programming, targeting our youngest citizens early in their young lives when the intervention can yield the greatest rewards, while others are not. House File 179 simply allows those programs that do not receive federal early Head Start funds to charge the state average rate for serving those children. It is a cost-neutral proposal for the state. With me today are Ms. Gail Kelly, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Head Start Association. I think she can take off with explaining the bill further.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Gail Kelly. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Head Start Association. I'm going to read my testimony to make sure that any kind of technical craziness about statute comes out clear, but I'm sure there'll be questions when I'm done. Minnesota's investments in Head Start and Early Head Start are very cost-effective. It's a great way to increase the number of children living in poverty that can receive comprehensive Head Start school readiness services. This school year, 2,678 children received Head Start and Early Head Start thanks to state funding. This augmented the 12,500 children that received services using our federal funds. In 1987, when state Head Start funding was first authorized, there was no Early Head Start program. Federal Early Head Start was authorized in 1994, and 14 Minnesota programs have successfully applied and been approved to provide federal early Head Start programs out of our 35 Head Start programs in the state. Early Head Start is a year-round intensive program that focuses on helping pregnant women and families with children under the age of 3 promote the healthy development of their infants and toddlers. The average cost of Early Head Start is higher than Head Start because of its intensity and the high qualified staff it requires to administer. average cost for early Head Start is $10,700 compared to just under $7,000 for Head Start. Minnesota previously had allocated a small grant program known as Birth to Three that allowed non-federal Head Start programs to provide services to children under three. That funding was unallotted in 2003, and at that time the state Head Start statute was changed to allow all Minnesota Head Start programs to serve children under the from 0 to 5. In the past year and a half, we've discovered a problem for non-federal early Head Start programs that want to provide early Head Start services using their state funding. The statute reimburses programs for services based on their federal cost per child. If a program has both an early Head Start and Head Start cost per child, they have no problem with the statute. But Head Start programs without a federal early Head Start program, early Head Start cost, have been instructed that they can provide early Head Start services, but only at their federal Head Start rate. We have a growing group of qualified programs that are offering early Head Start services using state funds, but they cannot provide the full intensity or duration of services because they are limited by their lower cost per child. This statute change would allow any non-federal early Head Start program to charge the average early Head Start cost, $10,700, for these services, and would ensure that all families participating in this program get the full intensity and complement of services afforded by federal early Head Start standards. This statute change would impact 22 Minnesota programs that don't currently have federal early Head Start and would expand services across Minnesota to our most vulnerable families at the earliest stages of their child's development. This change would not impact the amount of resources Minnesota invests in the program, but it would help us target these services more effectively in communities across Minnesota. Minnesota Head Start is committed to providing services as early as possible to those families who need extra help navigating parenthood or have children with special developmental needs. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about the statute change.
Okay, thank you. You know, I'm going to interrupt for just a second for special introductions. We have some special guests up in the audience. Former legislator Gary DeCramer and his group. Do you want to fill us in just a little bit to Professor DeCramer or introduce your group? Well, thank you for being here, and members, as mentioned, from the Humphrey Institute, the International Fellows, right? Professor DeCramer, or?
Two of them are MPA students, National Fellows. And two of them are International Fellows.
I see. Okay, thank you. I received my MPA last year. I actually graduated the day we were in session. We were just talking about that, the Sunday, and Representative Dabney's in the program now. So with that, we will move forward, but glad you're here. Thank you. Who would you like to have go next?
Madam Chair, we could have Jan Herseth from the Otter Tail Lavina Community Action. Please speak now.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for letting me come to speak to you about the proposed statute changes that will, if passed, have a very positive impact on early Head Start programs and the children and families we serve.
We need you just to say your name for the
record. My name is Jan Herseth, and I'm the Head Start and Early Head Start Director for a community action program in West Central Minnesota that covers Otter Tail and Wadena counties. 4 years ago, we received permission to use some of our state funds to change some 3 to 5 preschool slots to early Head Start. We started out with 12 families, and over the years we've progressed to 48 families enrolled in our Early Head Start program, and we have a significant waiting list. to be honest with you, I'm just not sure what I was thinking at the time we started our early Head Start program, because after we got into it, we were informed that our early Head Start cost per child funding could not exceed our federal cost per child funding. The problem being that of the 35 programs in Minnesota, there are only 4 programs that are funded lower than ours. There are 30 programs that receive a much higher cost per child funding. And that's another story for another day. But we are held to 100% of the same standards and requirements that all other Head Start programs are held to. Early Head Start programs that are federally funded, like Gail said, average $10,500 to $10,700 or $10,800 per child. So when I did the math, I knew our program could not, on $6,400 per child, provide the full range of Early Head Start services that other programs provide, and yet our communities were asking us for help for families of very young children, starting with services for pregnant moms and their new babies. Because of our funding limitations, we can only offer a very abbreviated program for our Early Head Start families. So we are grateful that we can offer what we can offer, but this change in the statute would be so helpful to our families. I will be overjoyed for our families and the additional opportunities they will have to help them become self-sufficient, successful parents, and contributing members of their communities. It will help us offer concentrated, more intense, and a wider range of needed services, including child care partnerships, mental health and wellness support, nutrition counseling, continuing education towards a GED or other professional certification program. Education is the key for these young parents to become successful, and with the GED process so much more complex and intense than it used to be, it is absolutely critical that we help our young families with needed intense emotional, financial, and other resources that Early Head Start has to offer. All of us know what the research says about brain development, and we know that all of it says earlier is better. Earlier equates to so many more positive outcomes than we ever imagined. Early Head Start can be, and often is, a partner with a family from pregnancy until the child is 3. And that is a term of almost 4 years. I can guarantee you that I will have significantly more positive outcomes for a family in Early Head Start for that length of time than bringing a child to Head Start at the age of 4 for 9 months of service. The dollars invested earlier are dollars invested wisely. In closing, I'd like to share with you a story about a young father in our program who's from a very small rural town who found himself to be a single dad of a brand new baby following the birth of the child. Without Early Head Start in the life of that father and his child, I know they never would have made it. And there would have been one more child in the very expensive foster care system. The Early Head Start support system kept them together as a family, and now they have a loving family of 2 parents and a child. They have many hurdles ahead of them, but I honestly believe that their prognosis is so much brighter than they would have had without Early Head Start. The neat part about it was that in our program, we have a staff member who is also a single dad. And so he moved right in to partner and mentor with that family and stayed with them for a lot of time, spent a lot of time with that family. Another quick story in closing, yesterday or 2 days ago, we gave an Early Head Start application to a very young father of a very young child who will now be spending the year here in the cities with a child who is facing 60 chemotherapy treatments for eye cancer. And so that will be an instance where Early Head Start can truly make a difference for that family. on our limited resources. And it's just change to the statute goes through. It will mean a world of difference to him and many others. Thank you, and I'll answer any questions.
Thank you. Very, very compelling testimony. So thank you. Representative Dabney?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Last testifier, perhaps the most important, a parent of an early Head Start child, Julie Cutche from Brainerd.
Welcome to the committee, if you can state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Julie Cutche. I'm from Brainerd. I have two children. My oldest is 4, and my baby is 1 month old. They are both in Head Start. My 4-year-old has been in one form or another of Head Start since she was 6 or 9 months old. When I had my oldest, I knew nothing about babies. I knew I needed to feed and change her, and I liked to hold her, but as she got older, I really didn't know how to relate to her. I wish that I had known about early Head Start sooner. Those first few months were very difficult, and I could have used more support. I was on my own. Early Head Start helped me learn how to communicate better with my infant. I didn't know what I was supposed to be doing with her. When my oldest was a little over a year old, she began throwing violent temper tantrums. I was so frustrated and hopeless. Her early Head Start teacher, Allie, suggested I cut pictures out of magazines of children's faces displaying different emotions and teach my daughter different words for those emotions. For that state of her life, it worked, and the stress level in our home went way down. They helped me understand how my daughter was developing. Allie taught me fun things that I could do with my child, like putting Play-Doh in Ziploc bags and watching her squish it around. It was a busy time in my life. I was just beginning college and working close to full-time to support us. It was really nice to have a teacher come out and help me refocus my attention on my daughter. Early Head Start and Head Start has parents make goals for their families and then help us make plans to complete those goals. While my family has participated in Head Start, some of the goals we've completed have been to learn to budget properly and pay off my car. Head Start referred me to another agency that was able to teach me how to budget better, and I was able to pay off my car with my taxes 1 year, which freed up a bunch of money monthly and allowed me to stay in college. One goal was to start getting my oldest to bed at a decent hour every night. Head Start taught me to create a routine and be consistent. Another goal was to get my oldest to eat at mealtime. Head Start suggested we eat meals at regular times at the table with the TV off, and it worked. Since our little family started working with Head Start, one of my ongoing goals has been to quit smoking. Head Start has made referrals for me, and it has taken a couple years, but I quit smoking last June, and I'm still doing great. Another goal we had was to eventually buy a home, and last April we bought a beautiful little house that we could afford. Finishing college has been an ongoing goal. I changed my major several times, but this May I will graduate and become an RN. I got married in 2008 and was pregnant with my second baby. I had trouble with the pregnancy, and I was on bed rest and then limited activity for the rest of my pregnancy. An early Head Start teacher, Jessica, came once a week and spent time helping me get through this tough time. She brought materials for me to read about my baby's development, and she coached me on nutrition and exercises that I could do while I was on bed rest. She supported me emotionally. We weren't sure our baby would make it. Jessica also helped me study for college. It was convenient that I was learning about obstetrics that semester, and I was able to pass that semester with an A. Jessica went on maternity leave for her own baby in November, and the replacement teacher, Kim, started coming and bringing many resources about infant care. She loaned us her personal videos about labor, delivery, and baby care so my husband could watch them when he got home from work. These videos and reading materials have been particularly helpful to my husband. My second baby is his first. The materials that Kim bought have helped him learn basic baby care and given him confidence in caring for the baby when I'm not around. I've struggled with learning to nurse my baby. I formula-fed my first child, and I was nervous about trying to learn to nurse the second. Kim brought over materials on breastfeeding. My baby had trouble with her latch, so Kim brought videos showing babies latching on, and my baby and I eventually caught on. Kim has also brought resources and advice on how to help our older child adjust to a new baby. This has been a difficult time for our oldest, and getting advice on how to help her has really made a difference for her, and she loves her baby sister. Early Head Start has done a lot for our family, and I know it has helped other families too. Thanks for listening to my personal story. I hope that it helps you with your decision.
Well, thank you, and congratulations on quitting smoking and your two children and everything. So, thank you. Are there any questions, members? Representative Ward and then Representative Peterson.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you, and Ms. Cutkey, it's nice to see you, especially all the way down from Brainerd. And say hi to all the cupcakes for me, please. And actually, it does relate to my question. I noticed that 22, Madam Chair, Julie, do you go to the Head Start right in Brainerd, right in TCC?
Madam Chair. Yes, we do.
Thank you. And the reason I ask that is I noticed that 22 out of the 35 agencies are receiving early Head Start money. Can you tell me, one of them is not the Brainerd facility, which I noticed, or it's actually listed under Little Falls, Tri-County Community Action. And can you tell me what the difference between those that were successfully receiving additional grant monies and those that were not?
Thank you. Yes, the Early Head Start expansion on the federal level has been very limited. Minnesota has a poverty level around 10% average. We're now up to 12. So we have gotten a lesser share of expansion dollars for Early Head Start. So TCC and the programs that are tribal programs and other programs that are currently federal Early Head Start programs got them very early in the process when those first expansion dollars were available. And we haven't been able to add many new federal Early Head Start programs since then. So we have more qualified programs because of the Birth to Three funds that the state had offered. I would be ready to go for expansion, but because we haven't gotten as many of those dollars, are limited. That's why it's so important to be able to use the state dollars for Early Head Start.
Okay. Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just trying to understand the funding piece because you get the fund, you know, you say this isn't going to cost any new money and yet you want, and I understand the statute is prohibitive, but where will you get the money for these additional Head Start programs if you can't use state or federal money, you know, it's not going to cost, or is there more federal money you can access to expand those programs?
The $20 million that we receive in state funds, each grantee can write a work plan of how they would like to use that. All we're asking here is for them to be able to allocate some of their Head Start slots and shift to early Head Start slots. So we're not asking for any new dollars. We're just saying the distribution of how much of that money would go to Head Start would be increased and less would be used for. We would shift more to early Head Start than Head Start. It's just. Each community has to do a community needs assessment and identify what's needed in their community. They write a work plan to the Department of Education about how they'd like to use those funds, and there'll be a slight different distribution than we've seen in the past.
Can I and one follow-up? Thank you, Madam Chair. You aren't denying any of the Head Start applicants, then, are you, or is this just you don't have as many ready for the regular and you'd like to go to early child or the earlier years?
Thank you. No, actually, it is. We prioritize children based on risk, and what we've been doing is just determining that the highest risk kids that are younger could get services, and we may not serve as many children in Head Start that have lower risk. So it's just playing the making sure that we distribute our funds to get to those highest risk kids first. And we know that with the highest risk children, if we don't start early, our efforts in as Jan said, our 9 months of 4-year-old program is not enough to be able to help them be successful. So it's just changing the how we use those funds, basically.
Okay. And members, I have a question from Representative Downey, and then what I'd like to do is make a motion to lay the bill over and move forward. So, Representative Downey?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So I think you've clarified my question, but the wording of the bill in 1.15 and 1.16, maybe somebody doesn't know that application process. Just to be sure, somebody who only has a Head Start program couldn't somehow be afforded the early Head Start rate and therefore be getting quote-unquote over-reimbursed for Head Start services. The application process requires you to kind of allocate slots and then the department approves them. Is that...
Ms. Kelly?
Madam Chair, yes. It's a grant process, so mm-hmm. the Department of Education oversees those work plans, and they ask for evidence from community assessment, and they make a determination if the distribution is right, and no, they wouldn't be able to use $10,700 for Head Start.
Yeah, thank you. So we're kind of block granting and allowing the facilities to make the best use of the funds.
Yeah. Yes, we're basically saying write a plan for these funds.
One follow-up, I think this is for Representative Dabney. The provision to not report the number of low-income children, could you just explain that briefly? I don't know what that provision was originally in there for and why its omission is important. Thank you.
I'm going to pitch that over to Ms. Kelly because she can explain the technicalities better than I can.
Ms. Kelly?
In the past, the way that was done was the allocation was divided by your federal costs, and you were told this is the amount of children you will serve. Now, if we allow for two costs, an early Head Start and a Head Start cost, instead of the department saying this is the number you will serve, you will write a work plan, and then we will approve the number afterwards.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Dabney, I do need to ask if there's anyone in the audience that would like to testify on this bill as we move forward. Okay, with that, Representative Dabney, do you have any closing comments?
Madam Chair, briefly, I think Representative Downey actually put it best. This is about allowing programs to make the best use of the monies that are available, work with their local communities to determine the needs, assess the children, take advantage of the flexibility, and make the best investments and the best returns. I'm also pleased I recognize that the Department of Education is not here in the room, but I'm informed that they are supportive of this. Maybe they are here in the room.
Yes, they are.
And there was a nice nod and a wave. So with that, Madam Chair, members, thank you.
Hopefully that wasn't just a greeting. Supportive. So thank you. Well, with that, members, we are going to roll this over, and Representative Coolidge-Jackson moves that House File 179 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Omnibus Bill. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you very much.
Members, we're going to take up two bills. We're going to have the switch here where Representative Rosenthal is going to come forward. I just want to talk a little bit, though, about the first bill is a dependent care credit is modified. If we could have the testifiers come down for that. That one we will be taking a vote on, members. It will not be rolled in. And the last bill will be rolled in for inclusion. So I just want to be clear, there will be a vote on this because we need to move it forward to the Finance Committee. So Representative Rosenthal.
Welcome, Representative Slavik. Would you like to move House File 276?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move House File 276. I have my motion in front of me. Just a second. I move House File 276 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Great. Could she?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Now.
Getting the lingo down, can you tell? appreciate you sharing. Members, this is about the state dependent share tax credit, and it's really a cleanup bill. This bill simplifies and streamlines state and federal dependent care tax credits. Dependent care tax credits help low wage working families make up the difference between modest earnings and the cost of child care that is necessary for employment and to make employment possible. Our state dependent care tax credit, when first enacted, balanced the federal tax credit. The non-refundable federal credit offset taxes for those with liability, while the refundable state tax credit provided assistance to lower income households participating in the workforce. So what happened over time, the credits have become out of sync and difficult to navigate, and they end up leaving the low-income families out who need them the most. So the interplay between the federal and the state-dependent tax care credits results in a structure that is complicated and, with respect to the funding, to the federal credit, somewhat regressive. So this bill, what it does is creates a more sensible interplay between the two credits and allows the state to fill in where the federal credits leave off. What I'd like to do, members, is have testimony on this, and obviously then we will take questions. So I have Marcia Abner, who is here, Executive Director.
Public Policy Director
of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Abner. I'm the Public Policy Director at the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. We are a statewide association of nonprofits with almost 2,000 active member organizations. And we do host the Minnesota Budget Project. The testimony that I am presenting to you is developed in collaboration with our Budget Project Director, Nan Madden, who has been stricken with whatever the bug is that's going around. We are pleased to testify in support of this bill. We think it will make important updates to the state's dependent care tax credit. That tax credit, as most of you know, helps about 36,000 Minnesota households pay for the child care that they need so that they can work. This legislation updates that dependent care credit so that it accomplishes three core goals. It works better with its federal counterpart, it is simpler, and it is more fair. The dependent care tax credit is related to the federal dependent care credit, and it's intended to make up for the fact that the federal credit is not refundable. When a tax credit is not refundable, it is of limited help to very low and moderate income families, the very families who need the assistance most. That is because these families may not owe much in income taxes, although they do pay other kinds of taxes. It's important to keep in mind that in Minnesota, households at all income levels pay about the same share of their income in total state and local taxes. That just happens to be a low amount on the income tax side for very low income families. At the same time, Minnesota's state dependent care credit has not kept up with various tax law changes over time. And now we seem to have a strange system in which some families get the state credit, some get both the state and federal, and some don't get any credit at all. This legislation, as presented to you, takes a very straightforward approach. It ensures that the tax credit fills in when Minnesota families don't receive their full federal dependent care credit. The result of adoption of this bill would be that the state and federal credits would work together seamlessly, that the tax credits will be easier for Minnesota families to understand, and that the assistance provided through the tax credit will be better targeted. We believe this is a good time to be reforming the dependent care credit. Refundable credits play an important part in ensuring that we have a fair tax system. Over the past decade, our state and local tax system has become more regressive, and this bill is one way to help address that problem. It's good tax policy, and we urge your support.
Mr. Chair, I just also want to say that the governor also has several tax credits, as we know, and in this kind of economy, this is something I think that we need to look at. He has offered the reinvestment credit for companies to invest in businesses, the job creation investment credit, the small business investment credit. So I think this is definitely complementary to those and something that should be considered. So with that, I would like to introduce my next witness, or Heather Gold.
Welcome. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Amy Brennan. I'm from the Office on the Economic Status of Women here at the Legislature. And thanks for the opportunity to speak to this bill and to reflect a little bit about on why our office thinks this bill is important. We actually became interested in this bill and the Child Savings Account Bill, the next one on the agenda that you're reviewing today, when we worked in partnership with the Poverty Commission last year. As we attended their tours across the state, we couldn't help but notice that the vast majority of those testifying and telling their stories about being economically challenged were women. And many of the women and families with whom we met were women who were working very hard to make ends meet. These were women working full-time jobs while their kids attended school and participated in out-of-school activities and childcare. They were thrifty, hardworking, and determined to get the job done for their families, no matter what the cost. Some of them were married, some of them were not. These were women and families who told stories, and as I listened to their stories and learned about their lives, I often heard about how they patched together child care and household expenses to get by, as we all have to do. They were definitely artists of good
deals. They stretched every deal as far as it would go and then stretched it some more. They found ways to pool their resources, to share responsibilities, and do everything they could to maintain employment and contribute to a stable household. We all know that child care and transportation are two important factors in maintaining employment. If those elements are not reliable, it's difficult to keep a job. And many of the families who would benefit from this bill are on the edge of economic stability, and this small amount of child care assistance through the form of a tax credit would improve their ability to maintain their employment and contribute to a more stable household. Every little bit helps. Women are working now more than ever, by choice and by necessity. Their presence in the workforce has increased over the years. In fact, as most of you know, we have one of the highest workforce participation rates in the country. Yet, for the majority of women, we're still pooled into occupational clusters with lower wage jobs. The top five industries right now in our state that employ women are healthcare, restaurants, nursing care, and education. And the percent of women in low wage jobs within those industries is very high. We also know that the situation for women and families in most parts of Greater Minnesota is even more pronounced. Wages that are lower, transportation is limited, and child care can be more difficult to access. For those low-income working women and families that I met on the poverty tour, and for all the hard-working families, this tax credit, this additional stitch in the patch, can make the difference. Thanks for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. Any questions, members? Senator Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So there's obviously some kind of financial implication, and I'm curious whether there's a fiscal note or some kind of budget advice coming with this bill to understand the extent to which this credit would be extending the tax credit liability of the state. Is that available or...
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, we did talk about this just before the meeting. I was hoping no one was going to ask this question, but I knew you were going to ask this, and I did show it to you.
Right.
I'll just say that. So we both knew this was coming. $15 million is the cost under it. Credits are not free. I mean, you think about that people are going to be getting more back, and there is a cost to it. As you know, as I said, the governor has proposed tax credits, so it's also... have a cost to them. This is in this kind of environment with a $4.8 billion budget deficit, we're going to have to weigh all those needs and about, is it about putting more money in the pockets of families that have kids to do have child care, or is it about other programs? As you know, that'll be the debate here.
Mr. Chairman, maybe just a comment, but also a question. I know in our taxes committee, as we are debating many of the other tax credits within the governor's overall budget proposal, kind of one of the disciplines that we're asked to adhere to is that if we're extending an additional credit, that we provide some means of, and I personally don't like this terminology, but it's what we tend to use, but how are we paying for that tax credit? In other words, are we removing other tax credits? Are there other budgetary cuts that compensate for that? Because in the end, we've got to balance debits and credits in the budget. So I'm curious, is there anything attached to the fiscal note that would provide a budgetary recommendation for other credits that we might remove from within the governor's proposal or other expenditure cuts in other program areas that would compensate for the lost revenue to the state?
Representative Flowers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, it's interesting to hear about the process in the tax committee.
Yes, it is.
Think about that more. I think in this type of environment, I am putting this out there without a specific tie to a cut or a reduction in a credit. Because there's so much in flux right now, I think that we're kind of waiting to see what the lay of the land is. We have the governor's proposal, obviously, is out there, and then the House will be having hearings, the House and Senate, and then we'll be putting out our hand. It will be a difficult question. I happen to know the taxpayers don't necessarily favor tax credits, so it's going to be a pretty hard sell, I think, all the way around, but that's what we're here to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kulik-Jackson.
Representative Solick, thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that the fiscal note is just about the pure cost, but what about an analysis of the financial benefits And I'm thinking of keeping people employed, because not only do they then, you know, contribute back to the state of Minnesota, but, you know, I've heard some pretty favorable statistics about what happens when families are working. Not just that their rates of alcohol and chemical abuse go down, that their rates of having any sort of visits from law enforcement go down, domestic abuse goes down, they stay out of the criminal justice system in greater rates, kids do better in school. I mean, it kind of goes on, and I think in fairness, when we're looking at keeping people employed and keeping the long-term costs down, it's too bad that we don't have a figure for the benefit of helping people stay employed, keeping the jobs.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Coolidge,
and I think that's an excellent point. Is really here in these times, we know that our families in Minnesota are struggling, and as well as in the country, and everything we can do to keep them employed and keep them have good, high quality child care is very important. Something we learned, I'm on the Poverty Commission, so I was on the tours, some of them, the same as Ms. Brennigan, and we learned that even $100, as much as $100 a month, makes those statistics you talk about much better. Things like domestic violence rates makes a big difference. So having extra money in people's pockets does make a big difference in the quality of life, especially for our low-income Minnesotans.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think Mr. Chair, sorry. Mr. Chair, see, I'm so used to no doubt. I'm going to ask the author. Well, first of all, I think the cost benefit analysis was given was excellent, because it certainly would pay off in so many ways. We all know that, and we just would need the data. But I'm just wondering, did anybody look at how low income families do they file taxes? Can you file a tax credit on a short form, and are there some things that we need to look at in terms of them taking advantage of this kind of program? And I say that because when we were doing some things with K-12 and tax credits, we found that many of the very low income families, just first of all, the delay in getting the money and a tax credit at the end of the year was difficult rather than up front, and some way of funding it up front seemed to be more advisable. And then many of them just didn't file the long form that was necessary to get that kind of tax credit. So do you have any information on that, and have you considered that?
Ms. Adler, to respond, I mean, I think that's the thing, I'll just say that we've thought about really the very low income are subsidies and what we deal with in this committee. And then you kind of get up more towards the middle income that are benefiting from tax credits. But I know we heard testimony, too, that can be an issue. Mm-hmm. Like this turns into sadness.
Mr. Chair and Representative Peterson, I don't have the technical answer to what's on the form, but we do place a very strong emphasis on financial education for low-income persons. There's the Taxpayers Assistance Program, which is designed to do exactly what you're saying, to help people with their financial literacy, to help them to understand what is available to them and how they file properly, regardless of their income level, and take advantage of some of the benefits that are available to them. And there are a number of really fine organizations that participate in that. They work with a number of accountants and attorneys and policy analysts on a voluntary basis. But I think that whenever we're looking at these programs, the point that you've raised is critical. We need to be sure that information about how to access these kinds of critical resources is very important for all the reasons identified. An investment that could keep a family working is an investment that keeps that family in the economy, spending money, being an answer to the very problems that we're facing now. We're much better off if we can keep people in their jobs and at work. So there is an effort to help people at all income levels, but especially low-income people, address their tax opportunities and their tax liabilities with a high level of knowledge and support.
Thank you. Good answer.
Thank you, Ms. Evans. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Chair. I just have a brief question, and I'm not sure if there's a concrete answer, but is it possible for an individual to actually get less money under this new proposal than they would have under a current situation? Is it possible that certain situations could work out that way, and if so, what about that situation?
I'd like to ask Nina to hand the house research taxes to answer that question. I know it has a variety of effects. You know, I think I worked on this bill, Nina, 5 years ago maybe? It was a long time. We've done this before, and so it's good to be have it back again. If you can help us out with the answer and introduce yourself. Please.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Nina Manzi from the House Research Department. And there are some parents who would be eligible for smaller state credits under this proposal. It would be typically parents who claim less than the maximum expenses for their child care credit, so less than the $3,000 for one dependent or $6,000 for two or more dependents. And then for single parents, it would be single parents who are earning from $29,000 to about $35,000, which is the maximum income eligible. They would receive smaller credits. For both groups, the difference in the credit amount would not be very big. For the single parents, it would be a pretty small difference. At the maximum, there would be like $40, I think, at the most. And then for the people with less than the maximum dependent care expenses, the discrepancy would vary depending on how much they had actually paid. Most of the examples that are prepared for this sort of thing assume that people have spent the maximum just because of what the cost of child care is. There are, however, people who may be eligible for basic sliding fee subsidies and who receive those subsidies. They all have a copay on their child care, and they can then claim the dependent care credit on their copay amount. So those parents will have less than the maximum expenses, and they may receive a smaller credit. But on the other hand, they would also be receiving a large portion of their child care paid for through basic sliding fee. Also, if there were someone who were paying a neighbor or in a family daycare home that cost less than the maximum allowed, they would be affected as well.
And do you know what percentage of the people who do claim this credit would fall in that range, the $29,000 to $35,000, who would have a less credit amount?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, I don't have for that particular income range. I do have somewhere in my folder here written down the overall number who would have fewer. In tax year 2009, there would be just over 4,000 people estimated would have a smaller credit, and then about 46,000 people would have a larger credit, and that corresponds with the cost estimate that Representative Slawick gave of about $15 million a year. So most of the $15 million is from the people who are getting more or who are becoming eligible, but then there is some of it is saved by a group of people who are receiving smaller credits or becoming ineligible. And the people who would become ineligible would tend to be people at the higher end of income eligibility for the current credit who are receiving small amounts of state credit. At the top end, the amount you're eligible for is $18 or $36 or something small like that.
Can I clarify, Mr. Chair? I mean, the information I had said that they would qualify maybe for a smaller or no state credit, but they would still receive a federal credit. So they would still get a federal credit.
Okay.
So it's just... when this came up, I think it was way back when Dave Freeman was working this committee, however many years ago that was, but a lot of states have done this, where they phase the two. I think there's a chart in your packet that shows the kind of cliff that the new one would phase it down. Jim Carlson is in the audience somewhere. He has sound effects with this apparently. And then there's this big drop-off. So it's to get a smooth transition with these families instead of the drop-off that you see here. So that's the concept behind it, and we would not be the only state doing this, and I understand that it's good policy is what it is.
Thank you. Representative Greiling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to say, kind of in response to Representative Downey, that
And to thank Ms. Representative Plowick for bringing the bill forward. You know, I think that we can't fund all the bills ever that come before us, but when even when we have a deficit, I think we have to kind of show our values and keep things under discussion. And it certainly, when we have big deficits in Washington, D.C., it doesn't stop people on Wall Street from coming and asking for trillions. And so I think that when we have, you know, issues for little children that are, you know, equally important, or maybe all of us in this room would think even more important, I think we have to keep asking and bringing bills forward. And these are bills that may have trouble this year, but I think, like the governor bringing forward his bills, and some of them in K-12 education cost millions of dollars, we still all have our duty bound to bring forward good ideas and put them in a mix so that they can be considered in the priorities. If we didn't ask, then some priorities, which just is one, would not be considered. So thank you. I guess that was a statement, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Riley. Representative Downey?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe a comment and then a follow-up question. Actually, I really appreciated Representative Cook Jackson's recap of the value of this bill. And it's actually a frustration of mine in the Tax Committee. Because we do static budgeting as compared to dynamic, we never really get to articulate the value of what we're talking about. We simply have to balance a tax credit, either with the revenue increase, the tax increase somewhere else, or the reduction of another credit. So my point isn't to argue the value. Actually, I'm on your side all the time over in taxes, but it's just the reality that we do have to apply that math at some point, and not applying it here seems to me to be a bit of an incomplete equation in terms of passing the bill on. And if we were simply laying it over for inclusion in the final bill, I think I'd be totally comfortable voting yes, given that we actually are, you know, actually voting on this and moving it on to committee, and could conceivably vote on this on the floor absent an overall budget package. I'm going to recommend, at least from my perspective, that we don't vote for that absent the kind of complete fiscal picture here. So I guess maybe that is more of a statement than a question, and I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
Representative Plowick, do you have any comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think that the tax bills always have to get bigger, wrapped into a large tax bill. It wouldn't go separately to the floor. We rarely take a tax bill up separately. So it would be, you'd probably be, have the opportunity to vote on this again, and it would probably go from finance to back to taxes. But just to say, I appreciate this discussion. It is a year where we have to bring up some bold ideas. I know a lot of things we're not bringing up. But I think this is one that's a good idea, and it's a good idea that we make it consistent for parents and don't have them falling off the cliff where they can't receive the money for the credit, and that we get some money into their pockets to help with their child care expenses, that we can help keep them in high-quality child care so their kids are in good places while they're working. So thank you, and thank you to my secretaries.
Thank you. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, Representative Slavik renews her motion to move House File 276 to be referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'd like to move House File 203 for possible inclusion in the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Bill.
Welcome.
Thank you. Well, members, we have one down. We've been kind of doing these bills together and preparing for the testimony on them together. They're somewhat similar in the idea of helping families. We have a number of testifiers here today, so we're going to have about 25 minutes, and we'll try to get through this. We have Catherine Solheim from the University of Minnesota. I have Steve Nagel and Kathy Overson, who have come out from the West Central Minnesota, who are going to talk about the funding program. And Arnie Anderson and Gail Kelly will talk about how this program can help families. This idea is a children's savings account. First of all, Mr. Chair, it is a delete all, and I think I need to move the delete all.
Yes.
Okay. Members, you have that in your packet. Is number H0203DE1. I'd like to move that.
Hello.
Thank you. So what this is, members, is we had proposed a pilot program on child savings accounts, and now it's a task force, because I think that we really are ready to start a step back and look at the overall process of what child savings accounts do. The idea that was brought up along the lines of the Poverty Commission when we're out talking to people is, how do you get families from living beyond the day-to-day and get into building assets, which will really move them ahead significantly? We learned about the importance of financial asset building during the life cycle of individuals from birth through the retirement years. The importance of this issue, financial asset building, is especially important today since individuals and families are more responsible for paying for higher ed, for building a nest egg for retirement, and having several months of savings for those times of economic downfall. My test cards are going to tell you more about how they fit in, so I'd like to proceed with them. Just a word about the bill that shows you it would be a task force, how it's set up, and who is involved. And, of course, we could, members, this will be rolled into this bill, so we could talk about if you desire some different folks or positions on there. It would be staffed under the Office of the Economic Status of Women. And the duties, I think, are the most important thing in the task force. Exploring a variety of funding mechanisms for child savings accounts, reviewing the lessons from the Universal Child Savings Account Program for the United Kingdom, reviewing the research from the National Seed Demonstration Program, exploring safe and effective investment strategies for saving deposits, exploring allowable purpose for the saving deposits, and so forth. So with that, I'd like to proceed with my testifiers, and we'll go from there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, is the PowerPoint working? Oh, that was it. Okay.
Thank you, Representative Follick, and Mr. Chair and members. My name is Catherine Solheim, and I'm on the faculty at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Family Social Science. I have been working with the statewide network of CAP agencies and other agencies across the state of Minnesota that implement the FAME program, the Family Assets for Independence Minnesota, which is the IDA program here in Minnesota. And I have been collaborating with them for 11 years, particularly focusing on evaluation, as they are trying to look at outcomes for families to see if their economic conditions are improving over time, which is the goal of the program. I'm here to tell you a little bit about assets and the importance of assets in family economic security, and I would say a movement across, actually it's a global movement, to move away from just kind of the Band-Aid approach to poverty to a long-term building, creating the building blocks so people can get out of poverty and stay out of poverty, and that is through assets. Assets are important to families, and they are stocks of resources. So all of us have periods of downtime over our lifespan. They allow for this smoothing of income versus kind of the income that goes up and down, so we can smooth consumption over time. They generate returns, and they do provide a buffer when we have job loss, illness, or income shortfall. And that is something that all of us experience. But people that are closer to the edge and in the area of poverty are especially vulnerable to this. I just wanted to point out, too, that there are lots of things that are considered assets. And they're tangible assets that most of us are probably most familiar with that have some dollar value attached to them, including real property, household goods, savings. Even intellectual property has dollar values, values attached to them. But there are also very intangible assets that we try to develop, and that is the human capital assets. We have cultural capital, social capital, access to credit, and political capital. All of these are very important, for, not only for families, but for communities to develop. What do assets do? They're very, very important dimension of kind of the behavior. They impact our behavior. They impact our capacities, our attitudes, and they work independently of income. So one of the key things that they do is they help people move toward a future orientation. I remember in the early 90s that I actually was at Auburn University in Alabama and working on welfare reform when we were having all the conversations about welfare reform. And we were doing financial education in rural areas. And none of it was really working. And what we had to do is take a step back, and we realized that a lot of families never had any asset experience. They did not have a worldview that thought through what's going to happen in the future. They were very present-oriented. And so when you think about it, many of us get socialized in our families in a way that we are future-oriented from early on. People ask us if you're going to go to college, what are you going to be when you grow up? It's a very different socialization process in families that have asset experience. And we're trying to get more people with that asset experience so they can have a future orientation. We also know that it allows for prudent risk-taking. For example, entrepreneurship in the U.S. is encouraged, particularly if people have assets that they can use as a buffer and an investment strategy. And that's very, very important. You know, homes are particularly the assets that get tapped for when people want to start small businesses. We also see very much the increase in social influence and civic engagement. People that are homeowners or have assets attach differently to communities. There's more stability in their lives, and they start to engage civically in very different ways. Household residential stability, I can't say enough about this. You know, stability in homes for kids is critical, and assets of particular home ownership has been proven to have a big impact on kids' development, certainly their attachment to schools and their attachment to communities. And I just completed a study with some colleagues in the same program where we looked at homeowners, people that attained homes through the same program between 2000 and 2004 in the pilot project. And of the close to 100 asset homeowners, we just did this last fall, all but three are still in their homes. They have, for the most part, realized increased net value of those homes. For some of them, have sold their homes, and they are actually have gained a net value in when they sold their homes. We did have three foreclosures, but in terms of an overall group of homeowners in this particular climate, it's pretty remarkable. Part of it has to do with the financial education and the understanding of the importance of this asset. Also, the coaching they got to get into a good mortgage vehicle. And so there's some really interesting things that are going on in the asset development area in Minnesota. Higher educational achievements, we find that there is a study that found families with as little as $3,000 in savings had greater odds of graduating from high school than children and families without savings. Now, there's a whole lot of things that are going on, but there's a lot of, the idea that there are assets and there's an asset orientation in those families makes a difference. There's upward job mobility. There's a study that was done in 2007 that found an 1% increase in wealth provides a 5% boost in a young man's chance of moving out of a low-wage job. Very important. Children's savings accounts are part of a global movement. If you see all of the different places that they are being instituted, and they are in different kinds of economies, from more developing economies to very much in information age-based economies like ours, market economies. But I think the one that you probably would be most interested in, and I think warrants for this study, is that in 2005, when Tony Blair was in office, they passed legislation that opened their children's savings account program that opens an account for every newborn, regardless of the income level. Now, they do have different amounts given to children based on their family's income. They also give a little boost at age 7, and it's linked to financial education. So it's not just putting money into an account, but it also helps children and their families see things that that they can do with those, and there's financial education connected. In the United States, we have something called SEED accounts, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, but the acronym stands for Saving for Education, Entrepreneurship, and Down Payment Initiative. And that started in 2003 with some demonstration projects. In 2004, the Aspire Act at the federal level tried to move this idea forward of $500 for every child. It did not pass, but it is still being talked about in D.C. We have these five initiatives going on now in Oklahoma, Arkansas, Texas, North Carolina, and Illinois, and they are all realizing very, very interesting results from those demonstration projects. This is a kind of a logical extension or next step in the asset development movement in Minnesota. Minnesota is really seen as one of the leaders in asset development accounts for adults. It's been a phenomenal program, public-private partnership, lots of community involvement, really strong results that we're seeing, and we're, you know, somebody that's at the university, and I've been called in to work with my colleagues because they're really interested in improving the programs to make it the best it can be and do well for the, and get good feedback. So they're really believers in the evaluation. So the expansion would be to have these asset accounts for children. What are the anticipated outcomes of a financial asset? Well, you'd have for children anyway, you'd have initial investments that grows over time, and then you would have the opportunity for families to contribute, children to contribute, and they would be used, could be used for things typically like education or college, a business asset or a home asset, depending on how a particular policy is structured. Along with that would go the financial management knowledge and skill development, critical. And I think perhaps the most difficult to measure, but one of the most important things is this early inculcation of asset ownership or savings values. We know that our whole country is not in a savings mode, and we are reaping the benefits of not having that future orientation. But you, if you have a chance to go to the Center for Enterprise Development website, you'll see video clips of young people. And one I remember particularly is a father and his son were talking about, they used to talk about if this young man would go to college, and now they're talking about when he will go to college, because it all of a sudden becomes a possibility when they have success in savings. I'm an old extension person, as those of you that know cooperative extension. I grew up in rural Minnesota, and the roots of extension were that there are reciprocal effects of youth when you invest in youth, and I call it the 4-H effect model. So when we used to teach kids about agriculture, they taught their parents. And one of the interesting things about this from a family systems perspective is that children having this account will influence the families and vice versa. My colleague and I followed 25 families in the same program for 4 years, and what we found was so consistent across these families was that they wanted something better for their children, and they wanted to instill the values of saving in their children, something that was missing in their own time of growing up. And this is an opportunity to do that through these child savings accounts. So I think that just gives you a little overview. And
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I think what we're going to try to do is get through our testimony here, and then if we have, hopefully we'll have time for questions. Do you have a question, Representative Ward?
Go ahead.
I'm getting a chair here. I can't. I come down. And it may take them a second to get set up with the PowerPoint here.
Sorry, yeah.
If you wanted to ask anything or discuss anything, or well,
it's actually already up. So if
we want, it up?
It's actually already up. So if we
want, it up?
Moving along.
Okay,
it would be great.
And these folks have traveled a couple of hours. I think they're representing Norness this week, and so I'm very pleased for them to be
if
here.
If not, they're neighbors.
And I met them and have seen them through various meetings. The Poverty Commission had a meeting last summer where you gave a training session. Well, it was actually for a number of different groups were there. So thank you for coming today.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Steve Nagel. I'm with West Central Minnesota Community Action. We're out of Elbow Lake. And we're the operator of the statewide FAME program. And today I'm just going to talk a little bit about the folks we serve in FAME and the success we have that we have had, and the for decades and decades, social policy has discouraged families with very low income from saving money. And I think the most blatant example of that is that for years the food stamp program would limit families from having more than $1,500 on hand, or they wouldn't be eligible for food stamps. So they would, you know, if they save more than that, they'd spend it, so they wouldn't lose benefits. And that's not unique to the food stamp program, but we've done that for decades and decades. And with the FAME program, what happens is we provide training for folks. They do some credit repair, and the families at 200% of poverty or less save up to $40 a month for 2 years. And they've saved like $880, and then their savings are matched 3-to-1, and they can purchase a home, post-secondary education, or a business investment. And to date, we've had nearly 1,000 families that have completed the program. We've got about 700 families that are in the program now, and on July 1, we'll enroll 350 more families. All this is done with a $500,000 investment every biennium from the state, and then that's matched with federal money. And what Ray Bouchara, who is one of the leaders in establishing the asset building, said, lack of income means you don't get by. Lack of assets means you don't get ahead. And some disparities in net worth, nearly one in five households in the United States today owes more than it owns. 21 million households. For every $1 net worth of a household headed by a white adult, a minority-headed household has about 6 cents. For every $1 of net worth in a household headed by a male, a female-headed household has less than 40 cents. And this is just a short chart on how FAME helps people build financial assets. First of all, we help families to increase their income, their financial literacy, and my colleague Kate Olverson is going to talk about that in a minute. We find ways for them to increase income and to make better use of the income that they have. They build savings, you know, they save over 2 years. And then the third part of the equation is that they purchase assets. And the assets are things that grow in value, purchase a home, post-secondary education, or some kind of small business investment. These are our partners. We're funded by the Office of Economic Opportunity and DHS. Twin Cities United Way, Bremer Bank, and the McKnight Foundation have been very generous to us. We partner with 22 community action agencies that deliver this program statewide, also Women Venture, City County Credit Union, a couple of the Native American bands, and the University of Minnesota has been helping us with evaluation and the Minnesota Community Action Partnership. Now, this is kind of interesting. 60% of our participants, 60% are Caucasian, and 40% are people of color, which is really a pretty remarkable average considering the demographics in Minnesota. And you see that the gender of our participants, nearly three-quarter of the households are women, and in the second graph, you see that really 98% of our the folks in the FAME program are working. And actually, the savings that they make have to be earned income. You know, they have to earn money and put that in savings. The earned income tax credit refunds are considered earned income. This is a graph of the incomes of the folks that are in the program, and you'll see that nearly a third of the families are less than 100% of poverty. The income guidelines allow families to be up to 200% of poverty, but typically community action agencies serve families with very low incomes, and this reflects that. The thing about the FAME program is that we want families to succeed. And we want them to be successful. once somebody meets the eligibility requirement, they're in the program for the duration. We want their incomes to increase, and we want them to succeed. Okay. Virtually all our households have children. I'm going to move a little quicker here. But this is some of the outcomes of what's happened to date. To date, 294 houses have been purchased by these families with very low incomes, and the average cost of $94,000. These folks have purchased houses worth nearly $28 million. The average taxes that they pay on those houses is about $1,800, which means $529 in property taxes as a result of this program. 311 have had post-secondary education investments, and this is using census data that folks that have a two-year certificate as compared to high school graduates earn $7,500 more a year. Based on the age of our participants, they have another 20 years in their work life, so they earn $150,000 in additional. and in the first 10 years of the project, our participants saved $880,000, and they received a match of $1,000,008. And this is just a chart of where these homes, businesses, and post-secondary investments were made. I'm going to turn over to Kate Overson, who's going to talk about the financial education component.
I'm going to say, members, you know, I know we're in a recess, so I am going to ask for your indulgence maybe for an extra 5 minutes. I normally would not ask that, but because we're here and we have questions tonight, anyhow, if we can go an extra 5 minutes, I sure appreciate it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, my name is Kate Overson. I'm the statewide FAME coordinator that oversees some of the program activities that go on with all of our partner agencies. I think one of the things that's extremely crucial to the success of the FAME program is the financial education that is a requirement for completion of acquiring the asset. And we sort of like to look at it as a building block process where individuals receive financial education, where in turn they develop savings and spending plans that help them think about what are their patterns of saving and spending and how might they alter those. They also focus on credit repair, which is an extremely crucial point for many people, not just low-income households, but people that have a fair amount of income as well. They focus on debt reduction. How do they reduce their indebtedness so that ultimately, if they're anticipating purchasing a home, they will have the best opportunity to get the most reasonable mortgage? And also, we focus on tax credit claims. How are people going to access earned income tax credit, for example, who may not have done that previously? And that's a huge piece. While the asset purchase ultimately, whether that's post-secondary ed, housing, or micro-enterprise, is certainly important, I think the financial education that is a part of the process and the asset-specific training, such as home stretch for home purchase, is equally as important. What we find in the households that we're serving is there's a trickle-down theory that happens, or an effect. As the adults in the household are receiving good, sound financial education in the classroom setting, as well as financial coaching in a one-on-one situation, what we're finding is that young folks in the household begin to pick up those strategies. An example of that is an individual that we had who took the classes whose daughter said to her when they went to the store, "Is this a need or a want?" And so there's some thought about really being mindful in terms of what's happening with their youngsters. And so we know that the financial education is absolutely crucial to the success of individuals acquiring their assets. We use a standard four cornerstones for financial literacy throughout the state, so there's consistent information being provided to individuals who are saving for their assets. And staff is trained in delivering those services so that, again, we have that consistency. And the financial education aspect of it truly is a very important part.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if there are questions, I told there's two. Yeah, they said they will pass in lieu of any type of questions.
Great. Representative Ward? Representative Downing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Alice, one question. How is this different from 529 accounts today? Is it simply kind of the things that you're surrounding the savings account with?
Well, I'll take a stab at it, and then I'll have okay. take a stab at it. Interestingly enough, I had an appointment on my calendar yesterday from the fellow who's over here who, if you want to raise your hand and wave, runs the 529 for Minnesota. So we had a discussion about that and sort of the differences. This is affectionately called baby bonds. So you give them to low-income parents potentially when, or all parents, I mean, that would be a legislative decision, when the children are born and they are in the savings account and then accumulate and have the match. I think the differences, and we talked about a little bit, where the income levels, they tend to get the higher returns. They like the wealthy grandparents, things like that, and ours is aimed at a different population. But I would hope maybe there would be a chance of partnership, and that's what we kind of, I was very pleased to have him make an appointment and come talk to me about that, because I think there is a lot of potential for maybe to work together.
Karen, just to comment, and this is fantastic and absolutely the direction we should be headed, so all my support. Thank you. This is great.
Well, thank you.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. it's fascinating, really interesting, and I'm actually sorry that we had to make it into a task force, but in this particular situation, it's probably better. But even grandparents who aren't wealthy do have 529s for their grandchildren, so I know a bit about for one. And the one thing that I saw that wasn't on here, which I thought was interesting, that they could also be used if something happened to the particular child, that it could be given for education to a relative. And that was, so it could be without the tax implications. So there were some ways that you could, that could be built in to assure that. But anyway, I think 529s and some of those plans are wonderful. So this seems like a good extension for people to get started. Thank you. Not a question, I guess, more of a comment.
Well, thank you, members, and I hope we keep this in mind. It is hard in these economic times to want to just go with the minimum and not think about ideas like this. But I think if we really want to help our families. Financial literacy education is very important in having programs like this. So I hope members will come out in the omnibus bill. And I want to thank my testifiers for traveling a long way. I also want to thank Amy Brennigan from the Office of the Economic Status Women for doing a lot of work on this, along with Andrea Lindgren, who is now in the Foreign Service, as well as my first testifier. I appreciate her being here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming down. It's an incredible program.
Can I roll it in? So, Mr. Chair, I move that my House file number, right? House file 203 is included
as amended
for possible inclusion in the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Bill.
Meeting is adjourned.